Welcome back to the Mopigs podcast. First, I would like to take a moment to discuss some changes to the podcast and the leadership team here at Mopigs. Hannah has stepped down as our leader due to increased career responsibilities. This means that me, Eric, will be stepping up as host for future episodes. Jorgos has also decided that as his PhD comes to an end, that he would also like to step down from the Mopigs team. Boya unfortunately couldn't join us for this recording, but she'll be back next episode. Anyway, as you may have seen in our newsletters, we reached out to the community to find some new board members, and I am super excited to welcome Spencer Winter, a first-year PhD student in the Chen Lab at Caltech, and Anuhia Udupaganti, a second-year PhD student in the Taylor Lab at Carnegie Mellon University, as our new panelists. We're planning a panel episode to better send off our former team members and introduce the new folks. Watch out for that as one of our next episodes. So with that, welcome, Spencer.
Hello, glad to be here.
Anuhia.
Hi, everyone.
I'm Eric, and this is the Mopigs podcast. Today, our guest is Victoria Glebowskite, a junior group leader at Ludwig Maximilian University in Munich. She did her bachelor's in chemistry at Jacobs University in Bremen and her PhD with Gonzalo Costa at McGill University before joining the lab of Philip Tinnefield at LMU to work on modular nanosensors based on DNA origami. She is now a junior group leader at LMU and currently planning her next career move later this year. Victoria, hi.
Hi, happy to be here.
Awesome. And always our first question in this podcast, how did you find your way into molecular programming and DNA origami? I understand you've kind of come a long way transitioning from chemistry to photonics into building things out of DNA. How did you get here?
Yeah, it was definitely not a direct path and probably the most indirect way. So when I started studying chemistry, my dream was actually to become a total synthetic organic chemist. So I did a lot of synthesis. And actually, when I was moving to McGill to start my PhD, I was still hoping to continue into PhD in synthesis. However, as some of you might know who are in North America, when you join for a PhD program, you get a chance to meet with a lot of different professors. And luckily, a lot of physical chemistry professors wanted to meet with me. And that's how I ended up talking to Gonzalo Costa, who was at that time had a young group of doing single molecule imaging. And I thought the idea of seeing single molecules and being able to observe them and study one at a time was super fascinating. So I basically did my PhD in single molecule fluorescence imaging, which was really exciting. And I really started liking physical chemistry a lot. And towards end of my PhD, I met Philip Tinnefeld, who at that time was moving his group from Braunschweig to LMU Munich. And he invited me to do a postdoc in his group. And he had a project going on where they tried to do single molecule imaging on a smartphone. And I thought that was absolutely crazy and really exciting. And it was actually one of the reasons why I decided to move to Munich and do a postdoc. And for those who are not maybe familiar with single molecule imaging, so one of the challenges is that it's not so easy to see a single molecule. There's a lot of like different tricks one has to play. And one of the tricks is that we need optical setups, like highly advanced optical setups, to be able to resolve a single from a single molecule. So usually we minimize the observation volume, and then we use really bright fluorophores. And that is actually both of these tricks, you cannot play them. So you cannot play the trick of really highly fancy setup if you want to see a single molecule on the phone. So we had to come up with other tricks. And then the trick that has been going on a lot in the Philips group was to build basically antennas that could amplify the signal coming from one molecule, from one fluorescent molecule on nanoscale. And that we did with the DNA origami, and that's how I got introduced into DNA nanotechnology. And then I thought it was absolutely fascinating, and this was such a nice synergy between my previous training, because on one hand, with the single molecule fluorescence imaging, you can see molecules on the ultimate resolution. And then on the other hand, now you can place molecules on the nanoscale. So I thought these two techniques were just match made in heaven.
What was the transition like as you jumped over? Was it a smooth jump straight into molecular programming and DNA nanotech? Or was it like the principles are different and the way that we think about molecules are a little different? So I'm curious how that pathway was for you.
That's true. It's a little bit different approach. But it's a very similar at the same time, because it's a very molecular type of thinking. So when you think of doing single molecule imaging, you're really thinking what happens between two molecules at a time, sometimes three molecules at a time. And then when you think of designing things on a nanoscale, you also have to think at the lowest level possible. So in that sense, the type of thinking for me was quite similar. of course, it was a huge learning curve for me, because I've never done DNA origami. I've never worked with DNA nanotechnology. But I would say it was very exciting. Like, just like learning about all of these possibilities and all of these new things that one can do was extremely exciting. And then later in my postdoc, I also got a chance to join Philip and another postdoc to design a new course, new master's course at LMU Munich, and it was on DNA nanotechnology. And it was so much fun because I was learning all of these different directions that the field is taking right now. And it was challenging to teach this all to yourself and then teach this to the students, but it was extremely exciting as well.
So DNA origami, you know, we always think of it as rational design, but there's also a fair amount of trial and error and luck involved in getting structures to assemble the way you want them to. Is it kind of the same when you're trying to design these high yield fluorophores? Was that also a lot of luck, or there's like really like rigorous quantum chemical calculations going into like preparing a new molecule that you want to image?
It's a really cool question. I think it's a little bit different. So I did a lot of work on single molecule photophysics, and what I liked there, it was a lot of mechanistic studies that you could do. So of course you could approach it via trial and error and say, well, I will try a lot of different additives and I will see if I can really maximize the number of photons I can get from my fluorophore. I can depopulate the dark states and things like that, and then kind of screen for new different things. But you could also approach it from a more mechanistic point of view and say, well, my fluorophore bleaches too fast. Is there something I could do? So you could design like a mechanistic study to figure it out. What is the dark state that's involved in the photobleaching pathway, and then more logically targeted? So I think there is a little bit more of this mechanistic thinking, I would say, when it comes to single molecule imaging and photophysics. Well, with DNA origami, I think you're right. There's a lot of trial and error, for sure. But what I find it really cool is that doing single molecule fluorescence imaging, a lot of the times you can also understand what's going wrong with your DNA origami. And that's kind of this intersection that I really enjoy as well.
Is there some parts of working with DNA origami that lied outside your expertise in photochemistry and single molecule chemistry? Like, what was the most challenging part, whether that's like learning softwares or just like getting a high yield of nanostructures, which at least beginner nanostructure makers deal with a lot? So what would you say was the biggest challenge of learning like new things about DNA nanotech?
I think for me was also this thinking how the DNA origami assembles and being able to visualize it in your head. I think one thing that you mentioned is definitely the software sometimes can be not super counterintuitive. Like, if you're used to always having a 3D model and like turning your molecule around and seeing where your, like, for example, thiol groups comes out and then there's a lysine group. And with DNA origami, you kind of, especially when cut nano, you had to kind of transition to this 2D thinking and then realize exactly how the structure could look in once you design it. And for me, it's also like the design rules were not always so obvious at the very beginning. So there were a lot of different, like, almost tips and tricks that one would have to know, that you really, like, I really had to like ask colleagues a lot who've done previous designs and worked with these structures. So I think, yeah, this like maybe thinking and visualizing the structure and then knowing these practical tips and tricks, what will work, what will not work, like what are the like design rules? I guess they're laid out in the literature, but there are some rules that people also implemented in their own lab. So it's kind of getting to know all of these little things, I would say, was probably the trickiest thing.
Little did we know this podcast was going to end up being an advertisement for the Art of Molecular Programming, that we need this textbook that tells everybody how to do things, since everybody has their own little methods. But anyway, transitioning to your time in the Tenefeld lab, kind of your first big project that you worked on was the Nachos system, right? Can you explain a little bit about how that works?
So as I mentioned earlier, in order to detect single molecules on the phone, we really needed to amplify their signal. And one way you can amplify the fluorescent signal is by utilizing unique properties of plasmonics. So what we basically did, we used DNA origami as a scaffold to assemble an antenna on a nanoscale. So the way this was working is that when we would excite our nanostructure that carries plasmonic nanoparticles. These plasmonic nanoparticles, when they're excited with light that are larger in wavelength than their diameter, they basically, what that leads to is the oscillation of the surface electron. And this oscillation of the surface electron, it actually enhances an electric field in close proximity to the nanoparticle. So now what happens if I take my single fluorophore and I put it in this enhanced electric field? There's actually two things that happens. On one hand, you really amplify the excitation signal that you're sending. So it kind of works like a magnifying glass. You basically amplify light that you're sending to that molecule. And on the other hand, this nanoparticle acts as an antenna. So you emit, the molecule emits the photons much faster. So then you're basically cycling to this excitation, excited and ground state much, much, much faster. So you can enhance fluorescent signals. If you put fluorophore to the one nanoparticle, it would be tens of folds. But if you couple two nanoparticles, you can enhance fluorescent signal hundreds of folds. But the question is, like, really, how do you assemble all of this? And this is where the DNA origami is really a key, because it allows you to position the two nanoparticles in a certain geometry and then place the fluorophore in between them. And this idea has been studied in Philip's group for many, many years, actually since 2012. But the main issue was that the way these structures were assembled, they always had an origami in between the nanoparticles. So the spot that had the highest enhancement was always blocked by the DNA nanostructure. And that was kind of sad, because if you want to amplify the fluorescent signal of, let's say, diagnostic assay, or like a bigger molecule that's labeled with a fluorophore, you couldn't do it because there was no space. So the Nachos was really like, the idea was like, let's clear this plasmonic hotspot. Let's assemble these nanoparticles and have a clear space. And then this clear space will work as the space where we can put larger biomolecules, diagnostic assays, and things like that. So we then, basically what we had to do is to engineer different assays that could detect different molecular targets. And then in parallel, we also had to build the smartphone setup. So we had to build like a portable setup where we could use them, these nano antennas and this amplified signal, to really see a single molecule. And that was kind of like two projects at the same time that we were working in parallel. And it was not optimizing just one. It was, in many times, it was optimizing maybe 6 or 7 different directions and then merging them all together to make it happen. But when it did happen, it was really exciting. It was really exciting to see the first single molecules on the phone. And it was a bit ironic, actually, because so I spent my entire PhD trying to make fluorescent molecules more photostable and make sure that they don't bleach. But the way we knew that we're seeing a single molecule on the phone was actually by proving that we have a single step bleaching. And the single step bleaching really proved that now we're seeing one molecule bleaching. And I never thought I would be so excited to see molecules bleach then. But it was amazing, also team effort. So it was many of us working on that project.
It's kind of deeply ironic that the bleaching is what you want to see. When you have this excitation enhancement, do you bleach the molecules faster than, or do they have longer lifetimes in this photonic cavity?
That's an excellent question. So lifetime, if you refer to fluorescent lifetime is actually much shorter. So because you excite your molecule and you depopulate so fast and it radiates the photons really fast, so the fluorescent lifetime is really short. But because the fluorescent lifetime is really short, there's less chances that the photochemistry will happen. So the molecules are actually more photostable. And this was actually the very, very first project that I worked on, was actually putting the fluorophores inside of these nano antennas and trying to understand the photophysics of these fluorophores. And we basically showed that the photostability of the molecule is improved around 40-fold, in addition to all the stabilization strategies that exist. So molecules are more photostable and they emit the photons faster, just to summarize it.
So with this kind of work, what is the characteristics of molecules that you can actually use with this approach? Like, are there molecules that can be analyzed this way, molecules that can't be analyzed this way? What kind of molecules are personally interesting to you in terms of application?
Excellent question. So as I said, like, we have a space now and we can put bigger things in there. But of course, you're relying on the fluorophore as a reporter. So what you can detect with this approach relies on the sensors that you can place in these plasmonic hotspots. And this is actually what encouraged me to work on these modular sensing strategies to basically speed up the way we can design the sensors, because we realized every time we wanted to detect something new in this plasmonic hotspot, we had to re-engineer the diagnostic assay completely and come up with a way how we would do that. So in this very first proof of concept publication, what we detected is just the nucleic acid. So we built kind of sandwich type of assay that is capable of binding a specific nucleic acid that was specific to antibiotic resistant bacteria. And then that can bind to the fluorophore. And then we would, by having a fluorophore in a plasmonic hotspot, then we would know that the target DNA was bound. So in the meantime, there was also a follow-up work where one of the colleagues in the group, she also showed that you can detect antibodies by working together with Francesco Ricci's group, who developed these nanoswitches to detect antibodies, where basically the closed form is quenched and then upon antibody binding, you unquench. So that was implemented in a nano antenna. And more recently, another colleague in the group, Leonard Carbonhorst, so he worked on basically putting different biomolecular interactions inside of the plasmonic hotspot. So he did FRET assays in the hotspot. Because you can imagine, because you have this enhanced emission rate and you cycling faster between ground and excited state, you also have a higher count rates. So what he did, he showed that you can get count rates of 10 megahertz in the FRET assays, which is something that's really, really difficult to achieve without this plasmonic nanoantenna. So this is kind of like the different targets that have been explored in the nanoantenna realm. But going away from the nanoantenna, I'm also really interested in also coming up with more modular ways to build sensors that could detect different molecules without having to re-engineer them over and over again.
So would it be right to understand that you're sort of looking at what kind of sensors have been developed and sort of like integrating that into your modular system? Or are you going to look into new kinds of sensors to analyze new kinds of molecules maybe?
So I guess you're asking more about the other project that I'm working on, about this modular sensor. So there was we were trying to work a little bit fundamentally on the challenges that one faces building sensors. So when you think of a typical sensor, so it usually has two parts. One part is this part that is some kind of like biorecognition unit that is capable to specifically detect the target molecule that you're trying to detect. And then you need to kind of relay that binding interaction into some kind of output, into the signal output or the transduction unit. So you need some kind of like either optical or electrochemical or electrical signal. So I come from the world of fluorescence imaging. So in our case, the signal is usually the optical signal. And the problem is that how you get this high signal is often very much related what kind of biorecognition element you use. So just to give you an example, like if you have a protein and the protein is the receptor that you're going to use to build a sensor, and let's say your target molecule binds to this protein and this protein might undergo a conformational change. And you could say, oh, great, I will use this conformational change now to put maybe a donor dye and an acceptor dye. And upon the conformational change, there will be a FRET fluorescence resonance energy transfer, and I can use this change in fluorescence resonance energy transfer to tell if my molecule is bound or not. But now, of course, how big this FRET will depend how big the conformational change is. So for this specific protein and for this specific target, then you'll play the game where you will try to optimize as much as possible to have this high FRET signal. But then whenever you start placing the dyes in the positions where maybe you will have a high FRET signal, you might compromise the affinity and your protein might not be able to bind so specifically anymore. And this is kind of like a tedious engineering step that is often has to be played every time we re-engineer the sensor. So the way we were thinking of kind of going away from this problem or like coming up with a bit more modular ways to make sensors was to use DNA origami, because this is where you can modularly assemble a lot of different things and perhaps overcome this problem. So the idea was, what if we take a DNA origami that undergoes a huge conformational change? And there we actually didn't even re-engineer a new structure. We used this hinge type of structure that has been used in literature a lot by Dietz group and by Castor group and also other groups now. And what we did, we basically put these dies on the different arms of each hinge. And then we basically have a close conformation of the hinge where these dies are very, very close together. And the open where there's basically really far apart. So there's no fluorescence resonance energy transfer. And what we did by playing with where we put the dies and how we put this die and a little bit with effective concentration, we could basically engineer a FRET readout that's no FRET at all to almost quantitative FRET. And then what we could do, we could basically build our sensor around these two conformational states. We could say, in the presence of the target, perhaps my sensor is closed. In the absence of the target, my sensor is open. And we're just basically coming up with ways how you can switch between these two conformational states. Now you have a really high optical readout. And this is kind of like how we approach this problem of always having to engineer this very high contrast. I hope this answers your question.
That was actually something I was really interested in. I don't have a background in diagnostics, but I thought it was very intriguing that your system uses essentially a not gate where it does something if something is not there compared to the other way around. Is that not standard in diagnostics, or is this a unique, unusual mechanism for doing things?
It's not a unique mechanism. So what this allows us to do, so basically the way we accomplish it, maybe I can explain you what you meant. Basically, the way we accomplished it, we on one sensor arms, we had like this sensing element. And on the other sensor arms, we put basically a target molecule. And then you have the target from solution outcompete your target on the other sensor arm. So as you said, in a way, it's like a not gate. But there are many sensors that have been built like that. So Kai Johnson's group built sensors like that using semi-synthetic protein scaffolds where you have this competing ligand that gets outcompeted with the target molecules in solution. So the similar ideas have been used before, and it kind of simplifies, because the only other way you would be able to flip between this like fully open and fully closed state is if you have kind of a bivalent binding interaction. So you would need to have like a molecule that bind to both arms. But if you don't have that, you can just basically use the same target and the same sensing interaction and then just use this competitive approach where your target from solution outcompetes your target on your sensor. So this is kind of a way to engineer sensors for molecules that cannot bind bivalently to both of the sensor arms.
Do you have much issues at all with false positives, the arms snapping themselves open because of random DNA interactions?
So this was a lot of engineering to have as least false positives as possible. So this project has been going on for several years now. So there was a lot of like fine tuning to find perfect place where the sensing elements would be put, where we would put the FRET arm, what kind of like step to ensure that the sensor is stable at different ionic strengths. So of course, once we started, there was a lot of these issues and it was like a lot of fine tuning. So I say, we want to avoid these tedious steps of engineering, but you have to do these tedious steps of engineering at least once. And then you can basically then use the platform to modularly exchange these sensing elements and detect different things.
Do you hit like a base rate of false positives just due to staple misincorporation in the DNA origami? And does that kind of tell us what the staple incorporation rate is for these origami structures?
Yeah, because in this case, if your reporting unit is a FRET pair, and if you're missing an acceptor die, you will always have a no FRET state. And in this case, with the highest FRET that we could get, the highest percentage of closed structures that we could get was 90%. And I assume that it is 90% because 10% of the structures are simply don't have an acceptor die. Yeah. But if you're doing this on a single molecule level, which is what we focused on. We actually focused on having the single molecule sensitivity. And the neat thing there is that you can really like read out what's going on in your system. So I think the level of optimization and engineering that we could do because we had the single molecule sensitivity was very different than what we could have done if we just read it out on an ensemble. Because we could always say, is it that our threat is low when the structure is closed, or is it that 50% of our sensors are open? And this type of knowledge is very useful when you're really trying to push it to the maximum signal contrast possible.
So reading your recent preprint, one of the things I thought was the most interesting was your discussion about the challenges of tuning the dose response curves across many orders of magnitude, from sensing single molecules up to sensing micromolar concentrations. You know, kind of naively, it's like, better sensitivity, always better. But from your discussion, that's not always the case. Can you like talk about that a little bit, about how hard it is to tune these dose response curves and when you want different types of responses to different molecular concentrations?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. And this is the second challenge that I didn't discuss. So I discussed the first challenge of having this high contrast. The second challenge that everyone faces is that, you know, if you take a sensing interaction, the sensing interaction, or like the receptor to sense the target, this will always have a certain affinity. So your sensor will always be sensitive in that affinity window. And that usually spans two orders of magnitude. And if you want to make the sensor now sensitive outside of this window, it's really difficult because you're kind of stuck with this interaction. So the way we kind of thought of going about it, we said, since we have a DNA origami platform, we are not stuck with one interaction. So now we can basically close this sensor with multiple interactions. And this allows us now to basically harness multivalency to engineer different dose response windows. So just to give you an example, if you close this sensor with six interactions instead of two interactions, you basically stabilize the closed structure. So if the target molecule needs to outcompete this ligand that keeps the sensor closed, you will need higher concentration of these target molecules. So this kind of allows you to shift to higher concentration ranges. And this is, I think you also asked for different applications where this could be interesting. What we didn't show in the preprint yet, but I think it would be really cool to show in the future, this type of ability to sense over different concentration ranges is really interesting when you start monitoring metabolites that can range in concentration at different orders of magnitude. The clinically relevant antibody concentrations can also range different orders of magnitude. And that's where the ability to monitor at these different concentrations becomes really interesting, and ability to monitor continuously. So there you really need a reversible sensor. That's, for example, in our case, if we open the sensor, we also show that if you use the reversible interaction to close it, it closes back. So basically, if you have a concentration of the analyte that gets really high and at some point over time drops, that you are able to read out those changes. Of course, this is the dream of the future, but the very fundamental strategies we tried to lay out in this first preprint.
Well, speaking of clinical options, have you gotten any kind of response from clinicians about your diagnostic setup? Are you looking for, or like, are you at the point now where you're looking to actually push it towards clinical trials, anything like that, or is this still very early days?
I would say it's still very early days, but once we started working on this, we actually had a really cool collaboration in Munich at Klinikum Rex der Isar from medical scientists who were interested in coming up with different ways to sense proteases. And they were really interested in Adam's T13 protease, which was involved in blood coagulation disorders. And the activity of this protease is very critical in basically determining different treatment plans for different disorders. And initially, they approached us because of our nano antenna approach and said, hey, could we make a better sensor for proteolytic activity? And then at that point, we were also developing this hinge type of platform, and we had like this very high signal contrast engineered. And that's how we started actually trying to build a sensor for protease. Because what you can do, you can kind of clamp the sensor with a peptide sequence. And then as the peptide cleaves out the sequence, there's electrostatic repulsion between two sensor arms, you have immediate opening, and you have a very high contrast. And this very high contrast is also really interesting in sensing proteases, because for proteases, you typically put these two dyes directly on the peptide, and then you need to screen a lot of different peptides, and that can influence your affinity of the protease to the peptide. And here we are completely decoupling the signal readout from the peptide sequence. So we basically now are trying to build this into this proteolytic sensor for ADAMS-T13 funded by the DFG. It's still not a completely clinical application, but it's towards that, I would say.
I feel like this is something that comes up every time any kind of clinical application for DNA origami comes up. Are you worried at all about enzymatic activity degrading your sensors?
Of course. I think that's what everyone is worried about. But I'm also very optimistic that this problem will be solved. And this is, this actually makes me think of the collaboration that we had with Emily Hora-Jungmann group, who's creating amazing strategies to address these problems. So she's covering the DNA origami structures in silica. And we've been working quite closely, and we're also trying to test whether we can protect our sensors as well with these strategies and then prolong the longevity, especially when you start to think about really like end applications where you want to use them perhaps in plasma or blood serum. So that's excellent. Excellent point. But I'm really hopeful that this is just a matter of time and this will be addressed.
One of the other things that often comes up in kind of clinical applications of DNA origamis is the idea of like price point of how expensive is this to produce and to analyze. And you mentioned in the end of the Nachos paper that the cover slips are relatively cheap to produce. You think you said $5 per cover slip, because you need like just a really low concentration of DNA origami since you're working at the single molecule level. And then the readout is on a smartphone, which is also a relatively cheap piece of hardware. Does this new system that you have some of the same advantages, or does it really need like the expensive readout equipment to be able to see it at a single molecule level since you don't have the enhancement?
That's an excellent question. So currently, as I said, we really focused on the single molecule sensing, which meant that we did use a single molecule dedicated setup. That being said, there's so much progress at the moment of trying to simplify the setups that one needs to detect single molecules. So I think it's currently, I would say all of the work we did was on complicated high advanced setup, but I don't think that that will be true 5-10 years from now. So I think that the technological advancement there is quite rapid as well. I hope that answered your question.
Yeah, that absolutely does.
Yeah. I mean, if you want to then use these sensors and make the unsampled sensors, of course, I think then you will really going to be limited by the cost in producing enough DNA origami. On a single molecule level, I think it's much easier to justify the costs.
That makes sense. So moving on to the kind of the second topic that I wanted to discuss with you today. So we kind of try to gear Molpigs towards like an early career scientist idea, and you're kind of at the perfect transition point as somebody to talk to here, since you are just finishing up your time at LMU and you're moving on to a new position. I'm not sure if I'm allowed to talk about what exactly it is, but let's just say that you have a new position and you're going to be starting a new group later this year.
Yeah.
So can you talk a little bit about your kind of evolution over the course of your postdoc? Because you came in as a postdoc, but now you're like a junior group leader at LMU. What has it been like a bit of graded autonomy there, or how has it been gaining more independence over the course of the last few years?
It was very organic for me, I have to say. So it was not certain criteria that you have to meet to be upgraded to a junior group leader. Or I think we started in the group when Philip moved from Braunschweig to LMU Munich, and I was one of the first people there as well. So there was a lot of responsibilities early on and a lot of projects that had to be pushed forward, but also a lot of new students to train. So all the students who joined in Munich basically was mentored by me and the other postdocs. And I found that really exciting. So I always like enjoyed working with students, and sometimes we even like worked with students together with other postdocs. So this whole process was quite organic. And I think the longer I was in the group, the more projects I was involved with and the more students I was mentoring and supervising, and that progression kind of happened naturally. And I guess more maybe more officially when that became more as a junior group leader is when I was able to acquire my own funding. So I had few independent grants from Center for Nanoscience to fund the collaborations that I had with other scientists in Munich. And then more recently, this DFG grant to kind of transition these sensors to a more clinical application. And I guess that independent funding is what really like ensures that you're a junior group leader. But I would say that the roles and like responsibilities that I had in the group, they kind of grew very organically. And I was just very lucky also that Philip was a very supportive mentor, and he always let me explore different topics and different ideas. And especially when it came to having different collaborations, I really could just start any collaboration, and he was fully supportive of that. So not sure if this answers your question, because it was not like a very hierarchical steps from one position to the other. It was more like this organic transition of getting more and more responsibilities, sadly spending less and less time in the lab.
No, that makes total sense. And yeah, I kind of feel that. And how long did this take you? How long have you been at LMU now in this, you know, organic growth of your...
It's been 6 years now.
Okay.
Could you briefly explain the junior group leader position? Like what goes into that? What is the career advancement after that? Because I'm not sure if it's something that we have in the US.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's also not something that is very well defined in Germany. So German academic system is very complicated. You can be a junior group leader, you can be a subgroup leader, you could be a junior professor, you could be an Eminator group leader if you have a certain Eminator grant. Like you can, it's just so many different types of in-between positions in Germany that don't exist in North America. And I can totally sense your confusion, because I also did my PhD in Canada. And for me, the North American system was so straightforward. You know, you finish your PhD, you do your postdoc, and for, I don't know, anywhere between 2 to 5 or 2 to 6 years, and then you apply for faculty positions. And then even then the hierarchy of the positions is very clear. You immediately need a tenure track. In Germany, that's can be very complex and very diverse and really depends on the place. So as I said, in my case, that really involved mentoring other students, sometimes being really responsible for the project and responsible for a certain collaboration and like really overseeing all of that, acquiring your own independent funding. In other groups, that means something completely different. There are like junior group leaders who are completely independent and they have their own group. I was still very much integrated in Philipp Dinnefeld group. I had a lot of responsibilities and I worked with many students, but I was still very much integrated in the group structure. Like we had the same group meetings. I was leading a subgroup in the group. So in our main group, we have 4 subgroups and I was leading one of them, the single molecule sensing one. But I can tell you, if you ask another junior group leader just next door, their way of being a junior group leader might be completely different, because it also depends on your PI. It depends on the structure in the institute and the structure in the department and the structure of the funding that is available. So I'm not sure there's one clear answer. So I think you would have to ask many junior group leaders in Germany to really get the feeling of what that means. Maybe Eric can add a little bit there, because he's also in Germany now.
Yeah, one other thing to kind of add to that is one of the big differences I noticed between Germany and the US is that the groups here are much larger and much more fluid. So you have a lot of students kind of transitioning in and out of these very large research groups here. And what this means is that like there's a lot of space to have these subgroups within like larger departmental groups and these kind of very flexible structures. It also means that like you have a lot more churn than you tend to in the groups in North America. So it has its pluses and minuses. You've got kind of more opportunities for mentorship, but you also are kind of always looking out for where your next student's going to come from, where your next opportunity is going to come from. It's a little unstable.
And it's very confusing in planning the next steps, because there's just 200 different ways that people do it. You know, it's not such a clear path. as it is in North America, which sometimes I miss that clarity a little bit and that certainty that, you know, at this point, this is what you, this is what, these are the types of positions you would apply. Well, in Germany, you can be in this in between position for a really long time.
So I kind of had a question about just different skills you feel like you needed to develop completely new at this point, because you said you're out of the lab a lot more and dealing with collaborations and getting independent funding. So like speaking as someone from like a who's just getting their PhD right now, like what are the sets of challenges you're encountering at the later steps that you wish you had developed the skills for earlier or thought about differently? So
it's an excellent question. It needs a little bit of thought to answer this question. It's I guess it's also difficult to say because for me it was so gradual. So it's not that I like at any given point they said, hey, I'm missing the skill. It was more like I was learning as I was getting these responsibilities, if that makes sense. But I think and it's also when it comes to, for example, grant writing, like I started that quite early. I like wrote fellowships for PhD scholarships in my PhD already. Of course, I didn't have like as much skill as like when I started writing my postdoc grants. And then now when I started writing the independent grant, it's just something that kind of grows over time. So I would say that the skills that you need as an academic, they're more or less stay the same skills. They just kind of improve, if that makes sense. So I would say you really need to be able to work in teams. I think none of the scientists is just like a lonely player in the lab. Like you're always gonna have to work in teams. And I think when you get more and more students or more and more responsibilities, the size of the team grows. So the better you are in like trying to bring people together or like make them collaborate together, bring different thoughts, different ideas, different backgrounds together. I think that helps a lot. But that also helps when you're a PhD student. Because when you're a PhD student, it also helps if you can team up with someone and like ask for help and like help someone else and learn from each other. So I wouldn't say that there was new skills. I would just say that these skills kind of, the same set of skills kind of get deeper and more developed, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. So you're saying it's just time and practice.
I would say so. I would say that a lot of these skills that I have now, I started kind of nurturing already in my PhD. And so, for example, I always really enjoy teaching. And in North America, I think that's a really nice thing. I think that we get to do a lot of teaching in grad school. And when you're there, and sometimes, you know, you would rather be doing research, but you have to supervise a lab or give a tutorial. Sometimes that's frustrating. But honestly, I'm so thankful for that. I'm really, really thankful that I had to do all of these things, because, you know, when you're like a second year PhD student and you're standing in front of 80 undergraduates trying to explain them physical chemistry, when up until that point, you were mainly doing organic chemistry and you may be teaching this to yourself like a week before and then standing in front of 80 people. The skills that you get doing that, you only appreciate later when you have to go to a conference and then speak in front of 300 people and you realize that part of the reason why you're comfortable is because you've been standing in front of like big masses of students and doing these tutorials and like sometimes really having to prepare yourself even last minute because there was not enough time because you were also doing research. So I think that those type of experiences that sometimes can be frustrating in grad school, I think they're, you really like learn how to appreciate them later because it gives you this like confidence and skills that maybe don't seem that they're related, but I think they are really related.
Another skill that I think is really underappreciated in group leaders is the ability to do kind of project and time management. How would you say that has developed for you as you went from, you know, managing your own time as a PhD student to now managing like a number of people's times through like project management?
I think it's one of the hardest things, I have to say. And I think I'm still improving in that for sure. It's also like a little bit difficult, especially if you want to be accessible and available to everyone. Like, you know, the more students you have, sometimes the more questions there are, the more help that is being needed. And it's, if you really just want to help and be as available as possible, often you would say yes, but then you realize that maybe certain things that you had to get done get postponed. So like, just to be very honest, I'm still working on this. Like, I'm still working of like, where is this perfect balance of like being available to the group and team that you're working with, but also getting the things done that you really need to get done. And like this famous saying, no in academia, it's still something that I think all of us are learning probably in the process. So
what was that application process like for applying to the positions that you have currently been entertaining? Was it a lot of essentially grant writing or a lot of interviews? How did you prepare for that and what did you have to do?
So it was a lot of like streamlining your ideas and then putting them in a bigger vision, I would say. But also, yeah, a lot of time in like writing these applications. It's something that one really cannot underestimate. If you're really applying to a position and you want to really convince that your application is really suited and tailored and show the interest, and like it does take a lot of the time to research the faculty, to research what research is being done at that place. So it's a lot of also like researching and thinking how you would fit in, and then kind of like a little bit of like strategy and thinking how your research vision would perhaps fit in into the research vision of the institute or the university. So it's I think it's easy to underestimate how much work is that if you want to really tailor your application. And in my case, I really limited my applications to Germany, so I didn't apply worldwide yet. And I guess that was also like, then you limit yourself to a limited number of opportunities, and that sometimes is stressful, especially during COVID. During COVID, there was not that many opportunities. And for me, that kind of coincided to the period of time when I was actually thinking about the next career steps, and like being in kind of a frozen time where like maybe perhaps there was not as many hirings and maybe a little bit less opportunities. It was not an easy period for sure. But I'm happy that it worked out, and I'm excited to start my own group soon.
In the long, long term, where do you see your career heading to? Like, what are your visions for the future?
It's a difficult question, because if you asked me at the end of my PhD, I was not planning on doing a postdoc. And if you asked me at the beginning of my postdoc, I wouldn't have said that I will necessarily become an academic. So I think the way I try to approach that in my career so far is a little bit follow the gut feeling and follow like kind of the interest and like the passions that I'm very excited about at that very given moment. And so far, I think it led me to really exciting places. And I can imagine a lot of different pathways leading to a lot of different directions, but I don't necessarily want to set my mind on one. So I hope that is not too non-specific of the answer.
Being flexible, you know, it's an important thing to think.
Yeah, I think one has to be flexible, especially in the current academic environment where things are so competitive, and sometimes things work out and sometimes things don't work out. When I was applying for positions, I knew that it might not work out, and I had to kind of be okay with it. I said, you know, if I will have to go and apply for jobs in industry, as long as I can still do science and still think on this molecular level and try to solve similar problems, I would be happy as well. So it's good to have big dreams and big ambitions, but I've also, like, personally, I always find it much easier to always stay a bit more grounded as well and kind of be flexible to new opportunities, because sometimes you have opportunities that you didn't even imagine having. Sometimes, at least in my life, I like, for example, the reason I moved to Munich, I was contacted by Philip and he told me about this great project, and like, this is something that I could not have planned ahead of. So it's kind of being open to these opportunities. It's also, for me, it's very important.
So always our last question on the podcast. Where do you see molecular programming in 20 years? And what is your role going to be in getting us there?
So I'm not a typical molecular programmer, and I'm someone who's really excited about this interdisciplinary science. So what I'm really excited about is to see how the molecular programming will kind of merge with all the other exciting things that are going on right now in research. So for example, we're learning more and more about nanoscale clustering of immune receptors, like as illustrated by beautiful work from, for example, our Fuhrman's group. And now that kind of creates a lot of different new niches where the molecular programming could go. So I'm curious how, like, for example, this area would merge with molecular programming. I'm also really curious how the molecular programming will use the new tools that are being developed. So for example, the protein design has came up with so many exciting new sensing units or new building blocks. And like, I'm personally the most excited to see how all of these fields kind of will merge in and come up with something greater, if that makes sense. So I will personally always be interested in making brighter labels and better ways to detect things. So I really hope that I can contribute somehow on this like sensing part, like this super precise, super sensitive sensor part, which could then be coupled to maybe some kind of actuator and then delivered for some kind of biomedical application. And then what kind of biomedical application? Maybe we don't even know. Maybe biomedical scientists will give us a hint what would be the most exciting application there. So I'm the most excited really to see where all of these super exciting directions would merge in and what role molecular programming will play there.
That is such a beautiful, holistic and cross scales and cross disciplinary vision.
Really wonderful.
Thank you. It was really nice to chat with you.
Yes, thank you so much for joining us. So stay tuned to our newsletter and our Slack channel for details on our future podcast episodes and reading groups. And thank you for listening. See you guys next time.